Welcome everyone to this episode of Speaking of Translation. I'm Eve Baudet.
And I'm Corinne McKay. Thanks for joining us.
In this episode, we'll be discussing the professional networking site LinkedIn, and we'll also be talking about our own personal experiences with it and how you might make the best use of it as a freelance language professional.
Thanks, Eve. And as usual, we'll start with a short update on what's been going on with us. So most of my time has been taken up with my new pandemic adventure, which is that I am now a student in the York University Glendon College Master's in Conference Interpreting Program, which I guess is a pretty big new development. So I've been thinking for honestly probably 5 years at least about maybe doing a master's in conference interpreting. And I had been looking at this program for a while, but honestly, I was too afraid to take the advanced entry exam to try to be admitted to the second year of the program, which a lot of conference interpreting programs let you do, but I was too afraid to even try. And I also couldn't really wrap my head around how I would move to Toronto alone for a year, since my husband has a job and we own a house here in Colorado and my parents moved here to be closer to us and all kinds of things like that. But then things really fell into place after taking the Cambridge Conference Interpreting course in August. I finally worked up the courage to take the advanced entry exam and I passed it. And the second year of the Glendon program was moved mostly online. So I will probably go to Toronto for part of the spring semester, but nothing close to the whole year. I'm working on a blog post about it, but it's going great. I love it. It's keeping me busy in these very crazy times. So Eve, what's been up with you lately?
Well, first, before I move on to me, I want to say congrats, and it's super fun to hear about your interpreting adventures. And it is kind of cool how, like we talked about in some past episodes, the pandemic has a lot of negative stuff, but in this case, it actually helped you kind of achieve this goal. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it did. It was a, I mean, I hate to see anything positive about the pandemic, given the number of, you know, that feels a little bit, you know, mean-spirited to see anything positive about the pandemic. But I think it's a horrible situation that does have some silver linings.
Yeah, and it's just making lemons out of lemonade.
Yeah.
Lemonade out of lemons, I mean.
it presented an opportunity that I think I wouldn't have been able to take advantage of for a while. So,
Good. Well, on my side, I just wanted to talk a little bit about, I know listeners have heard about it before, but the Global Reads Book Club for Translators is going well, and we're currently reading our fifth book, which was a lot of fun. It's a little bit different style than we previously read. The current book, number 5, is a light Swedish mystery about a murderous little old lady. So most of us so far have thought that was like hysterically funny and had a good time reading it, even though it's kind of out of our normal genre. And we voted on our sixth book that will be reading in November and December. And if any of our listeners would like to join up, I will be continuing to host the book club in 2021, I decided. And so we'll put the sign up again, sign up link in our show notes.
Yeah, and I will say, Eve, and I'm not saying this just because I'm the president of your fan club, I see a lot of buzz about Global Reads. I will say that I even have a consulting client who put her participation in Global Reads on her resume.
Oh, so fun.
I know. So I really think, you know, this sort of, you know, crazy big dream that you have has really got some momentum, and I see lots of people talking about it.
That's super fun. I know I need to put it on my resume.
Oh my gosh, you really need to put it on your resume. Are you kidding me? If participants are putting it on there,
yeah.
You absolutely
I'm
do.
Behind the curve there. Yeah. So and then I was also recently interviewed by Isabella Massardo for her blog, and that is Smart Reads, her Smart Reads newsletter. And we'll put the link to that. And in the interview, we talked about a lot of things, translation, maintaining your second language, etc. So go check it out. And my 84-year-old mother was excited to read it, and she knows nothing about translation. So hopefully some of our listeners will be too. So yeah, great.
Fantastic. And Global Reads got me to read fiction for the first time. So like really the only fiction that I read is Hilary Mantel's Henry VIII trilogy. It's actually taken me the whole quarantine to get through the most recent one. But other than that, I literally had not read fiction in years, and I read the first book for Global Reads and loved it. So,
oh, thank you, Corinne. I'm glad
we'll put the link in the show notes and join up if you haven't already. Yeah. So Eve, to kick things off with LinkedIn, I think most of our listeners either already know or can research the basic idea of how to create a LinkedIn profile. But what tips would you have for people in our language professions, language industry, or for freelancers in general that our listeners might not have thought of?
Yeah, so the first thing that comes to my mind, which people may do, but I think sometimes it slips away from us in our busy schedules, is that make sure you take time to periodically revisit your LinkedIn profile at a certain time of year. Like maybe you think I do this every spring or twice a year in the spring and the fall or whatever. Kind of schedule that on there so that you do actually visit it and tweak it and update it. I think there are always ways that we can tweak our LinkedIn profiles and then seeing it with new eyes and perhaps in the context of where your business is at any given time or what's going on in the overall marketplace. When you do these periodic visits to your site, looking at it, you know, thinking of what can I change, the context of what's going on can lead you to make changes to the way that you present your profile. So that's one thing. Another thing is that LinkedIn, as we probably many people know, often updates things, changes things, moves features around or whatever. So be aware of various options that are available to you and also of things that might be new that you don't know of. That you can take advantage of. So, for example, it's not super new now. I came online last year, but I didn't find out about it until a couple months ago, was there's now a section in the profile that lets you show what specific services you provide. So, for example, and that's near the top, kind of near the up near the heading, the kind of introductory section of the profile. So, for example, on mine, I know that the services I provide are translated editing and project management. And I do think, I know Corinne and I have both talked about in the past before, that sometimes, and other people say this too, that we're kind of putting a square peg in a round hole or whatever it is, whatever that saying is, for being freelancers on this site that's mostly for job seekers. And I think when you make sure that you fill out the section about services you provide, then that really is differentiating you as a service provider rather than a job seeker. So that's one thing. Also, just in that same vein of thinking, make sure you use all the different sections that are available to you. Make sure you fill up the sections with licenses if you're certified or in any fashion by any entity, whether having to do with language skills or not. Be sure to fill that out. Also, don't neglect volunteer experience. So I think when you're filling out the volunteer section, it should be relevant to your overall profile and what you're trying to convey. So maybe you don't want to say, I volunteered to take cookies to my kids' kindergarten class or whatever. But, you know, don't forget to include volunteer experience that is relevant. So for perhaps you volunteered a lot for your professional association or you held office or whatever, even if it was volunteer. So be sure to include that. And the thing that I don't see that many people doing that I do, and I've had people comment to me that they liked it, was the project section. So that's a subsection under the accomplishments section when you're in there editing your profile, and it's kind of near the bottom of the profile. So I like to use that myself. And so I put examples of the work that I've done in that section. And I think it helps for potential clients to see, oh, these are actually kind of cool projects that she's worked on in the past. I don't put every single thing I've done, but I try to put, you know, something new in there at least a couple times a year of like, oh, this is representative of what I've been doing lately, or this is particularly interesting because it was a high profile client or whatever. And so, and I also use it myself, that section, like different times when I've been filling out information for a potential client not on LinkedIn, then I'll be like, oh yeah, I can go to LinkedIn myself and remind myself of this, you know, these projects that I could talk to them about. Another idea I had was do try to use some kind of image or photo on your, I don't mean your own photo of yourself, but the background photo, the big one. The banner, yes, thank you.
Canva.
I'm trying to think of the word.
Canva.
Yeah.
Put a link to Canva in the show notes. Canva has templates. That's for anyone listening who's never heard of it. That's Canva. The graphic design website for those with no graphic design skill whatsoever, i.e. me.
Yeah, me too.
They even have templates called LinkedIn Banner. So like instead of that default light blue banner, I mean, I made a banner that looks, you know, halfway decent, at least a quarter way decent. And it literally took me 10 minutes because they have free templates just called LinkedIn banner.
And they're already set up like the right pixels and all that
Correct.
Kind of stuff. So yeah, because I've done that before years ago, like, oh no, no, it won't fit or whatever. And like you said, that's not my, I'm not a professional designer either or even a volunteer designer. So yeah, like Corinne is saying, you know, use Canva to create something or use something that related to your logo or whatever, but just having something that's not the default LinkedIn background makes you stand out also. So another thing that I think is a good idea is to view your profile as others see it so that you can really see about how you want to tweak anything. Like look at it as another person, as an outsider, and then think to yourself, oh, I thought this would come across, you know, this section would look like this, but I don't really like the way it looks now that I see how other people see it. And it used to be easier to do in LinkedIn, and for whatever reason known to LinkedIn people internally there, it's harder to find how to do that now. But I came across a link that if you're logged in on LinkedIn and you use this link, it'll show you what it looks like to other people. And then on the right side of the page, if you're logged in again to your account, it'll also show you how you can turn off certain sections. Like you may decide, oh, for whatever reason, now I want to turn off the volunteer section so people can't see it. And if you click that button on the right-hand side, it'll show you what it'll now look like to outsiders. And so we'll put that special tricky link in the show notes so that you can do that. Another thing is that I think it's important to remember that within most sections and subsections, you can move the order of various entries around. So such as past volunteer jobs or your education or maybe past positions you had before you became freelance or whatever. If you want to emphasize one more than others for some reason, rather than just listing them in date order, you can do that. And what I've seen, for example, for me, what that happened was when I wrote my book, because it was newer than when I'd started working for myself, it pushed it to the top. And I'm like, well, okay. Like that was the date wise. It was the newest thing, but it was kind of weird that was
But you've
first.
Been a translator for 20 years.
Yeah. So
you don't necessarily want to eclipse that with your book, although your book is wonderful.
Yeah. Right. No, but right. That's what I thought. Well, this is kind of weird that this is listing first. So then, and LinkedIn has had that ability for a while, so maybe people do know about it, but for a long time they didn't have that, so it was like super frustrating. And I think people finally, they listen to people complaining, but just know that you can do that. And for that's an example, you may have a new thing where you're working part-time for some, you know, kind of volunteer thing again, and you don't want it to show up first because it's, you know, it's important, but it's not the most important. So you can move things around, pulling them around in different order than the date order, and so that's important to know. Another idea is consider adding a business page as well. We're not going to talk a lot about that today or anything, but just that, you know, even if you're a freelancer, you're an individual and you may have your business. And so you can link that to your personal profile page. And my one suggestion about that is use a logo icon for the business page and have it linked to that business page. So a lot of times, especially for self-employed people, I'll want to find out more about their business online. And then it's just that little gray box, you know what I mean? Instead of a real logo next to their entry of their business name, there'll be a little gray box and you can't click on it. And so what you want to do is make it so that you do actually have a business page on LinkedIn. So then when you enter, like, I work at, you know, Joe's Translation, which is my own company or whatever, then when people click on the box, it takes them to the business page and tells them more about your company, more about you. So you have the business page and the profile page. And that's another opportunity to share information about what you do instead of them thinking like, oh, it's not, you know, it's not a real business. It doesn't seem to have a business page or it doesn't link anywhere or whatever. So I think that's another opportunity, another marketing space you can use. And then this sounds silly, but I don't think it actually is. And the reason I don't think it is because, like I said in earlier when I started in the industry, and I still get a lot of resumes from translators, one thing that you would not believe, but it's true, is that many people forget to put their languages on their resumes. Which seems funny, but weird. And I think the real reason that that happens is that to them, it's just so obvious. They don't even think about putting, oh yes, and my languages are Italian and Dutch or whatever. Because in their own mind, it's obvious and they forget to put it down. And then they're sending out their resume trying to get work as a translator and they haven't put their languages down. So what I'm really going to say is that in LinkedIn, there is a section near the bottom too, under like the accomplishment section, where you can add what languages you actually speak. So I assume if you're a language professional, you would have some of this information also in your heading way at the top of your profile, but then you also want to add it into the they have the actual fields, you know, instead of free form, it's fields in a section where you can put in your different languages, which will help you get found too. And not just ignore that like people sometimes do in their resume. and before I finish up this section, I wanted to mention that there are articles that I've come across that are specifically geared toward translators improving and language professionals improving their LinkedIn profiles. So, you know, as Corinne said earlier, there's a lot of general information out there that can be helpful. You know, look up stuff if you're really into LinkedIn. There's tons of cool information out there. But I think it's really wonderful to be able to read advice that's specifically focused on LinkedIn profiles for language professionals. And so we're going to put some links in the show notes to three articles on this very topic by Madalena Sanchez-Impalo. And also another translator, Miriam Hurley, shared an article that she wrote with me on this exact topic. And sometimes the things that they cover in these articles are really specific, but just doing that little tweak really could give you a boost, I think, on LinkedIn. So it's helpful to look at that. So Corinne, do you have any tips that you want to share with us on creating or updating a LinkedIn profile?
Yeah, I think you covered most of it. I guess the one thing, I have a couple sort of niche-y specific things, but the one thing I would sort of piggyback on with your stuff was volunteering. But the one other thing I would add, besides obviously put professional volunteering, is any volunteering that relates to things that you might want to translate about or that you've sort of gained expertise in because of your volunteer work. So for example, I do a lot of animal volunteering, like I'm a volunteer at an animal shelter and foster animals and stuff like that. And I would actually love to do animal translations. So I think I would put that. And then also one thing a lot of people wonder in terms of jobs or volunteering is, what about things with a sort of religious or political bent? People ask this a lot about resumes too. Mm-hmm. And usually my take on that, I'd be interested to see what you think, Eve, is like, only put religious or political things if it doesn't matter to you that clients might react negatively to it. So I think, you know, if you think being affiliated with this religious or political identity is so important to me that I don't really care if clients are turned off by it because I'm not going to hide it. but otherwise, I think I would not prominently feature religious or political things. What do you think, Eve?
I think that too. And I do think, I agree with you there, because that's kind of like that, we don't talk about this now, but it goes back to the rate. This, people have the discussion, should I put my rates on my website or not? And
right.
There's pros and cons.
Yeah.
Like if you feel like, oh, if don't care about those people you never hear from, then go for it. Mm-hmm, I mean, then do it, you know. And it may be really important to you personally, where you feel like, oh, if they would be upset about it, I don't want to talk to them.
I don't want to work with them anyway.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you feel like you don't feel that way, then you might want to leave it out. Or another thing is there is quite a bit of translation work specifically related to religious, you know,
right. I mean, that's the thing, right, is that actually religious institutions are pretty heavy consumers of translation work.
Yeah.
So then in a, you know, when you think like, or people say, which I would think is probably true, that the Bible is the most translated work, you know, ever. And if you look at, I believe when I did a presentation, was researching some sort of translation factoids, that the largest number of continuously maintained translation is the Book of Mormon. So the Mormon Church maintains actively updated translations of the Book of Mormon into, I don't want to say the number because I don't want to.
Many.
Yeah, but it was a mind-boggling. Yeah. Like even as a translator, it was a mind-boggling number of translations that the, you know, central LDS church maintains translations of the Book of Mormon into all these languages. So it could be a good business strategy.
Yeah. But I was gonna say, not just the actual sacred texts themselves that people might do, but also when I went to the New York Book Expo in 2019, there were different religious institutions who publish, you know, like their evangelical materials. So it wouldn't necessarily have to be like, I'm the one that translating
the
Bible.
But they have their own publishing, like a lot of
they publish a lot of literature, and so they do that.
Religions, right, even have their own publishing houses.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I guess my specific tips, and we can put a link in how to do this in the show notes if anyone hasn't done it, customize your profile link. So if you have never done that, then your LinkedIn profile link is something like LinkedIn/in/56 characters of letters and numbers that mean nothing. Yes. 56 characters of gibberish. And you want your profile link, like mine is LinkedIn/in/Corinne McKay. Or you could use your company name, or you could use German conference interpreter. It can be whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. As long as it's not already taken, yeah.
Point being, right, as long as someone else doesn't have it, then, which I was actually surprised that no one else had /Corinne McKay, but you could, you can have any, like any other URL, you can pick anything that anyone doesn't have already, but customize it to something. Mm-hmm. Number two, and Eve touched on these, but I'll just say them more emphatically, spell out your language pairs in words. So I give an example when I did a marketing presentation of someone who had like 6 sets of acronyms for their language pairs, and acronyms that only people in the language professions know mean that language. So, you know, some of the obvious ones, you know, I think most non-linguists could guess that FR is French. But when you get into, like, I actually think most linguists would not even know that DE is German. So spell your language pairs out in words. Don't use the abbreviation for them.
Corinne, I'm cracking up because as you were talking, I was like, I know I might have done that years ago, and I was like, oh my god, did I still do that?
Okay.
But no, it says French to English, so I didn't do that.
Right.
Everybody go check quick.
Right. Spell out your language pairs, and this seems really obvious, but state your language pairs. Every time I go on LinkedIn, I am stunned by the number of people whose job description is translator, court interpreter, medical interpreter. Well, the number one thing we want to know is what language?
Exactly.
So put your language pairs in your headlines. And then the main thing is, I feel like I should put this author I'm going to recommend on commission because I talk about her post so much. There's a translator who is also a marketing specialist named Maeva Cifuentes, and she wrote an excellent article that I think is really one of the most detailed things about LinkedIn for freelance translators and interpreters. And actually those tips that I just gave with the spelling out your language pairs are, she includes those in her article as well, but we'll link to that. But other than that, I think you covered it, Eve. That was great. So why don't you tell us, Eve, how do you personally use LinkedIn? And I wondered specifically, do you actively connect with other people or just accept the contact requests you get? And do you publish any content on LinkedIn?
Yeah, so just thinking about how I personally use it. So like I mentioned earlier, I do try to schedule a couple times a year to kind of do an official, you know, spend a day or whatever, or maybe like a week doing it over different times over the week. So I have my fresh eyes throughout that time I'm looking at it, to do an overhaul, revisiting my heading, adding, like I talked about, adding projects. And then of course I may do it more often if something specific comes up for some reason, you know, like, oh, I need to look at this or whatever, for whatever, some client triggers it or something like that. So as for connecting with others, I do try to connect with others that I've met online or in real life, you know, that I have some specific connection with. I mean, the connection with a small c that I've met in some other way, right? Though I've also noticed that sometimes I'm surprised when I'm not connected on LinkedIn to someone that I thought I was, So it's worth also periodically kind of doing an audit, or whatever you want to call it, of your real life or your email contacts, and comparing it to your LinkedIn contacts, and then make sure that you are indeed connected to the people you think you should be.
That's sometimes, so true, because sometimes you have people you work with all the time and you never even thought to connect with them on LinkedIn, which is bizarre.
I do that too.
I'm not saying it's bizarre that other people do that. I'm saying I do that too.
Yeah, it's just what I had in my notes here was the connections are so obvious that we actually aren't even connected to them because we just think they are or whatever. Like one I had was my a conference friend, Christopher Carey, who's another English to French translator from Canada. And I had known him for years. And then I realized I'm not connected to him. So I connected to him. And then as you said, I often do get asked to connect on LinkedIn. And if I think it's legit and we have a legitimate connection in some fashion, or we already have multiple connections in common, then I accept. And I'm also more likely to connect if someone sends me a personalized message. And I know everybody says this, but then people don't do it. So so it's worth, you know, repeating. So my idea behind that is if we have something in common, or we know someone in common, then whoever wants to connect with me can at least tell me that in a short message, you know, because for me, even the people that we, like you said, we forgot to connect to, even though we know them really well, I'll even send them a message, you know, I'm not just going to send them, an unpersonalized message. So it's kind of weird to get a connection request with no personalized message. As for me actively connecting to people, so I'll go through stages like throughout the year. Maybe like in the spring, I'll do a whole bunch of, outside my normal online and in real life contacts, like we talked about, which obviously we would connect to. I will actively go through stages where I try to connect to people with a certain industry. I'm sorry. Try to connect to people within a certain industry or that have some kind of commonality with me. And so like I'll make a specific, it is sort of a marketing effort, right? You know, a specific effort to do that. So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but often it does. And I do think it's good to expand outside your own network from just the language industry. So what I mean by that is in some ways I feel like, oh, this person wants to connect with me, or I want to connect with them. And we have 70 contacts in common. That's awesome. But then I feel like there's all these kind of overlapping things, which can be good. But in another way, I think for growing your business and widening your network, it actually seems better to me to connect with someone who's totally new, who has no connections in common with me, or maybe who has one or two connections in common with me, and as opposed to like every single other person I know on the planet. Somehow that just seems better to me to widen my network than having, it's not bad to connect to other people with whom I have 70 contacts in common, but it seems like for the purposes of widening your network, it's probably better to connect with people. Somehow that seems more valuable than who have less connections in common with you already. So I try to do that. And then you talked about, Corinne, you asked if I publish. So my comment on that is, from that perspective, I'm kind of lame. And I know I should publish more on LinkedIn or participate in discussions there, but whatever, for whatever reason, I'm behind the curve on that and I don't really do that. So we can't all be perfect, but I do as I say, not as I do. I think it is a good idea. And, someone who's more active in that can talk more about that, because I don't really do that, even though I know I should, and I try to think about doing it and never really follow through. So the main thing that I use LinkedIn for is research. So I use it to research trends, to research companies, and to research potential clients. So I use it for a ton of research, and that is my main purpose. You'll read LinkedIn saying, we're the largest business database in the world. And that's, really seems to be true. And so I, even though sometimes like I do try to look at other business databases, by the way, which is a different topic, like at the library, your library often, at least in the US, pays for expensive access to different business databases. But LinkedIn is really probably one of the larger ones and available to just regular people too. So I use it for mainly for research. So Corinne, how about you?
Sure. So I have a pretty open LinkedIn non-strategy. which is that pretty much I accept any request where the person has something in common with me. So I find, like you said, Eve, over time now, almost no one sends a personal note with the connection request. When I send a connection request, I always include a personal note, even if I know the person. But I would say, just for everyone's information, probably 10% at most of the connection requests I get have any sort of personal note, and they're all from people I don't know.
Yeah. That's kind of weird.
Just if you want an insight into what other people are doing on LinkedIn, I always find it a little weird that one of the reasons you can reject a LinkedIn connection request is called, I don't know this person. And I thought, like, does LinkedIn realize how people actually use their site? Because if that were the criteria for rejecting someone, I would reject literally 90% of the requests I get are people who I don't know and don't include a personal note. But during a recent experiment on LinkedIn, which I'll talk about in a little bit, I realized that I need to be more proactive about sending out my own connection requests in a more targeted way. I do publish quite a bit of content on LinkedIn almost exclusively for other translators. Mm-hmm. So the three things that I have experimented with are LinkedIn posts, LinkedIn posts about my blog posts, mm-hmm. and LinkedIn articles that are reprints of my blog posts. Mm-hmm. So, and I'll tell you how those three things work. So LinkedIn posts, you know, you can go on there and it's like doing a Facebook status update. You know, you can just type whatever you want or put a link to whatever you want. And I find those generate quite a bit of traffic, but it's almost like a mini blog post, except more active. And then you have to go respond
to everybody.
and by that, I don't mean like, woe is me, all of my raving fans. I don't mean it to sound that way at all. I just mean one thing to think about is that to me, over time, blog comments have gotten less active, even when the traffic to my blog is pretty high. Like lately, I've been posting to my blog more regularly, so traffic is back up where I want it, like, you know, close to 1,000 views a day, usually like 700 views a day, maybe. But not very many people comment compared to, you know, the olden days. The olden days of blogging. But LinkedIn is a lot more active. But the thing is that then I just think out of courtesy and to maintain that traffic, you want to go respond to people.
And then so you have to be able to invest the time if you're going to do it, you're saying.
Correct. Yeah. And then an interesting thing I found is, for me at least, doing a LinkedIn post that is a link to my blog post generates a lot more activity than publishing that same blog post as a LinkedIn article. I have no idea why, because I thought like, oh, I'm going to have this, you know, whole new way of generating traffic on LinkedIn by reposting my blog posts as LinkedIn articles. That was not successful at all for me. I get way more interest when I just post a short update.
And then, like, and then it links to the blog post. That's super interesting.
Exactly.
As opposed to posting the whole thing, you're saying.
Right. Okay. Right. And I have no idea why.
Okay.
So those are my thoughts on how I use it personally, because I'm going to talk in a little bit about my recent LinkedIn Premium experiment.
Okay.
So moving on to the topic of LinkedIn Premium, if you don't know what LinkedIn Premium is, you must be living in a place that doesn't have the internet. Because every time I go on LinkedIn, I am probably, like all of you, bombarded with ads for LinkedIn Premium and the whole, like, you know, wonder who else has looked at your profile? Sign up for LinkedIn Premium and unlock unlimited profile views or whatever. LinkedIn heavily, heavily, heavily pushes Premium. So Eve, I know that you are a LinkedIn Premium user. So two questions, what made you decide to try it? And how long have you had it, and what use do you make of it?
Thank you for asking. So going back to my idea of research, basically that's what encouraged me to pay for premium. And I just saw today, as I was just doing a little bit of research on my own account for this podcast, it says I've been on it since 2000 paying. I mean, I paid different times over the years here and there, but I've been paying pretty steadily since April 2019. So a year and a half or whatever. And the reason I did it is that I signed up to avoid hitting what is called the commercial use limit when doing research on LinkedIn. And the issue for me is I kept hitting it. So the weird thing, not weird, but I talked to other translators like you and Catherine Grisaki and different people over the years who've said that they have not had this problem. And even some people I consider power users. So you do see this mentioned in various articles on the internet because I've researched it. Like, what the heck is the commercial use limit that I'm hitting? And so I don't know if I'm just some crazy obsessed researcher on my own that triggers this. Yes, when I stay up till 2 a.m. researching, I'm just kidding. But I don't really think so. What exactly triggers the commercial use limit is, you know, of course, secretly guarded as a secret by LinkedIn. But what you can find is that it's something that kicks in when your search activity makes LinkedIn think that you are trying to hire people or that you're prospecting for new clients. So if they think you're using the searching for that, you know, if whatever you're doing is triggering them to think that, then they want you to pay for access instead. Because like, you know, there's different levels, like Corinne mentioned, there's the premium, but there's all those different levels of paid LinkedIn that you can do. And they try to focus it on like, oh, if you're prospecting for new clients, you should buy this version. Or if you are looking to hire people, you should buy this version of our paid product. So there also are various articles on the internet of how to get around the commercial use limit of hitting that. But as I found over the years, LinkedIn is always changing how things work on the back end for this commercial use limit and lots of other stuff. So often, once articles are published that tell you how to work around the commercial use limit, then they change how it works in LinkedIn, and then the workaround doesn't work anymore. And so I just feel like it wasn't worth it for me doing that kind of stuff. And the workarounds are often very labyrinth and kind of hard to do. Mm-hmm. So it just wasn't worth it to me. And I don't want, when I'm trying to research things, have it keep telling me you've reached the commercial use limit. Mm-hmm. And so... So related to that, I did want to talk about, it seems that just if people are now worried about reaching the commercial use limit, if you browse your own first degree connections, that does not count against the commercial use limit. If you search for people by name, so even if they're not in one of your connections already, if someone said, oh, you know, Corinne, look up this person, XYZ person, and look at their LinkedIn profile, they'd be really interesting for us to interview for the podcast, then it's not going to hit go against it either if you look for someone by a specific name. And also exploring, sometimes it'll suggest to you the people you may know feature, that also does not go towards your commercial use limit. So if you do that kind of thing, it's not going to have you hit the commercial limit. So what does hit it, make you hit it, is, you know, using keywords and filters and clicking on LinkedIn profiles from people in like the also viewed section. Like, you know, sometimes you'll look up somebody and then they'll say, oh, people who viewed this person, it's like on Amazon, right? Like a product, people who bought this product also bought this product. Do you want it? And so it'll say, you know, you viewed this person, and then people, you might be interested in this person too. So that kind of thing does go against the commercial use limit. So basically, it's a long-winded answer to your question. I use a premium mainly to avoid hitting that commercial use limit because it drives me nuts when I'm, you know, doing all this research or looking at different potential clients from different angles or looking at different trends or whatever. I don't like hitting that. So that's why I did that. And you also mentioned, Corinne, I think that with premium, you also do get better stats and information about who's viewed your profile.
And that's how they suck you in, right?
Yeah. And actually sometimes, I mean, I'll say what I think about that in a second. So I like that. And I look at it often to see if there's somebody I do want to connect with. So I do that, reach out sometimes like, oh, I don't, not super creepy, but like, you know, I saw you're visiting my website or my profile, but you know, sometimes they are amenable to that perhaps if they look interesting. So it depends. And you can also see like what the profile is most of the time. And is it a colleague? Is it a potential client or whatever? But sometimes even in that case, you can't see it because you can block, you know, as one, even just a regular user can block if people see who they are looking at them. So if someone has chosen to block that, you can't see them, even if at least the level of premium that I am, you can't see that if they've said that they don't want people to see it. It'll say like, a person in the blah blah industry is looking at you, but it won't tell you anything else about them, even if you're paying for it. So, and also sometimes it's interesting, but you know, sometimes I think like, okay, a bunch of, you know, other colleagues looked at it. Not that I don't like my colleagues, but it's not that useful, you know, right. Or other people that I already know or something like that. So that I would not pay for premium just for that, but it is a benefit that exists. So I might as well, you know, look at it. So, and then with premium, you do get in-mails, which is basically to email people, even if you're not already connected to them, like doing it through LinkedIn's kind of email feature. But I'm kind of lame again about those two, and I don't really use them, even though I have like a gob of them, because then I start adding up, you know, they'll be like, now you have 55 in-mails. You get, for the level that I have of premium, you get 15 a month. And then I don't use that. So I mainly is because when I have gotten in-mails from other people in the past, they've been like kind of salesy or spammy or whatever, and I feel uncomfortable then. Like, I'm like, well, you know, I've shied away from using it for myself unless I have a really specific reason. Like, I actually have this question I want to ask somebody or whatever, I don't know, because I think people will ignore them. But I may be missing out on that, and I think that I may be, and when I hear what Corinne has to say, because I think I might have been kind of looking at that the wrong way. And so what I've really done in the past is use LinkedIn to research about a person, and then I find their email address with other ways that we can talk about in another episode, and I think we've kind of mentioned before, and then I email them directly with their email address. And I have felt like that's more likely to get a response than using in-mail, but I'm thinking that I may be wrong about that. So, and that segues exactly into what I want to ask Corinne.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know that you recently did a 1 month experience using LinkedIn Premium. And so tell us about that.
Yeah. So I'm going to put a link to my blog post in the show notes so I won't, you know, glaze your eyes over with all the details. But the point being, I decided to just do the 1 month free trial of LinkedIn Premium because why not? And the main thing that I would say is, you know how sometimes when you do a free trial, like on LinkedIn, you do, like for every free trial, have to enter your credit card information. But you know how for some things that you do a free trial, it turns out to be basically impossible to cancel before the deadline. Like you have to call Azerbaijan only on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You know what I mean? Or they put up these like ridiculous barriers that makes it basically impossible to cancel. LinkedIn Premium, I don't see a reason not to do the free trial because LinkedIn Premium is very easy to cancel. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would do is, if you're just doing free trial as an experiment, one mistake I made, why not just do the highest level? Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like, after I only thought about that afterwards, I was frustrated about how few in-mails I got because the number of in-mails depends on the level of premium. So premium goes from the basically job seeker, they call it premium career, that's $30 a month. And then you can go up to recruiter, which is $100 a month. But mm-hmm. the thing is, I think for the purposes of the free trial, why not just get recruiter?
You know? Right.
So I should have done that. It's like, no, I want the lowest level of your free thing instead of the highest level
of
your free thing.
Well, the one thing about that, though, is you actually maybe were right to do it that way, because if you got, you wouldn't know which features weren't available to you anymore necessarily, and the one you'd actually pay for. You know,
oh, that's,
I mean,
actually true. Yeah, okay, so that makes me feel better. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to do blah blah blah. Oh no, right. I can't do it now, and you'd be kind of mad because you'd be mm-hmm. like, "I thought I could do this when I'm paying for it. Anyway."
Mm-hmm. Right. So if I want to give you just a, you know, 30-second summary of how it went, I thought that the results for me, at least, were about the same as email marketing to people I don't know. So if I compare it to sending short, personalized, highly targeted emails to people I don't know, I felt like the response on LinkedIn was about the same.
I'm super excited to hear that, actually. And see, I've been wrong all this time.
Yeah.
Well, maybe my emails aren't as good as yours. That's something too, you know.
Well, no, my emails are like super boring. So I don't think that's possible. I'm just saying
there's other factors in there that we're not considering in. But if we just look at all other things being equal, you're saying right. that you got the same return.
Mm-hmm. But so the whole thing about, I mean, now granted, I only did it for 1 month, but I did max out, you know, the amount of in-mails and connection requests that you uh-huh. could send. Uh-huh. But LinkedIn's whole thing of, you know, they actually quote on their website, in-mails have a 300% higher response rate than emails with the exact same content. That was not my experience at all.
I did wonder, actually, though, I do want to say another factor that maybe we're not considering is, I was just wondering about the pandemic, you know, that we can't control it now, but that's an uncontrollable variable, maybe.
That's true. I don't know. Yeah. But one thing, so I think, is premium worth paying for as a freelancer? My sense was probably not. I mean, the one caveat here is like $30 a month isn't nothing. Like, I think, you know, that would be one of my higher sort of subscription fees. I do have things that cost more than that, like MailChimp. I now pay almost $70. But $30 a month sounds like a lot. But on the other hand, if you got even one medium size job off of it, that you would pay for like your whole year. I mean, so if you think of it this way, it's, you know, under $400 a year, and $400 is, you know, not a huge translation job, right? So in that sense, you know, I think, I don't think that it's overpriced. And I also think that if you got even a small amount of work from it, it would be worth it. But I just found personally that the response rate to in-mail specifically was about the same as what I get to regular email, which is free / I'm already paying for it anyway. Mm-hmm. But the one thing I will say is it really taught me that I need to be more proactive about reaching out to people, because I targeted a few different constituencies of people on LinkedIn, which in my specialization. So I targeted people who work in Africa or Haiti programs at NGOs, people who belong to some of the same international development groups on LinkedIn that I belong to, people who work at credentials evaluation services, and people who work for in-house translation departments at companies in the US or Europe, or heads of translation services at translation agencies. Mm-hmm. So I will say—
It was real specific.
Yeah, so I was pretty specific. And by doing that, which I could have been doing all along with the free LinkedIn, I know. I think it's just proof that like, there's always more to learn about marketing, you know? I even teach marketing classes for other translators. And I ended this by saying, oh, wow, I could have been doing this all along with the free LinkedIn membership. That I found that if you connect with people in a targeted way and say why you're contacting them, that even just that little note you can send with the connection request, I believe it's 300 characters. Mm-hmm. So basically with an in-mail, it's like sending an email. I don't know what the limit is on the length, but I never reached it. Like you can basically send what you would send in a normal email, whereas with a connection
request. As long as you're not blabbing on for whatever. Yeah. And some I've received, some emails I've received are pretty long.
Wouldn't
write them that long, but they're pretty long. Yeah.
Right. So even the 300 character note that you can write with the connection request, I ended up with one person who works at a very large, promising NGO who said, oh, as luck would have it, we were just talking the other day that we've sent specialized translation work to an agency and weren't happy with the results. So we think we're going to start working with freelancers. So that was pretty huge.
Yeah, yeah.
And awesome. Then I found what looks like a really good European translation agency that sort of targets my specializations. So I mean, I think the verdict is either it was a total failure or it was a success,
depending how you look at it.
Because in one sense, I thought like, you know, either this is all stuff I could do with the free LinkedIn membership, or it's the same results I get from email. But on the other hand, it motivated me to be a lot more proactive. And just out of, I believe, I sent almost exactly 100 contacts, either in-mails or connection requests, and that I got 2 really promising inquiries, not just, you know, thanks, we'll keep your information on file, which I would still see as positive, but 2, like, you know, the agency said, oh, we're always looking for US English translators because they're harder to find in Europe. And one was this NGO saying, you know, funny you should mention, we were just talking about maybe switching to using freelancers. So there you go. And I'll put the link to my blog post if you want to read all of the eye glazing details.
And I have a question for you, another question for you. Okay. And that is, just confirm, have you ever hit the commercial use limit?
I don't even know. I don't even know what that is.
I don't understand
you, it. You know that I love you, but I don't even
know. I know. I must be like some kind of crazy person.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
I know. Isn't it weird? I just think that, I don't know. Like, I must seriously, like, not knowing it, my OCD's coming out, right? I'm like some obsessed researcher or something.
It's a possibility. It's a distinct, I mean, we know that you like to take it to 11 in many areas of life. And I can't really tell, like, if LinkedIn has some vendetta against you,
or if you
are taking the research to 11 and you're doing like 8 times as much commercial research as anyone else who ever uses LinkedIn.
And one of the articles that I knew about this for, not about the commercial use limit that's haunting me for a long time, but I was doing research again, you know, this week for the podcast, and one person did say, and this may be true, and it's on LinkedIn and not me, was that this person who wrote this article seemed to think that maybe once you'd signed up for premium, they throttled you down a little bit because they wanted you to go back to it or something, which maybe, I mean, I don't know if that's true or not, but because I'm like, oh my God. I mean, like, I do a lot of research, but I don't think I'm much crazier than, you know, I'm sure you do good research too. And, you know, do lots of research for what you're trying to do. So I don't really understand that. And like
but
you said,
I wonder, I mean, of course, LinkedIn isn't going to tell you that, but I do wonder if once you cancel the free trial of premium, if they put some restrictions on your account to try to encourage you to sign up again. I don't know. Sounds like kind of a conspiracy theory, but it might be good business sense on their part.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I'm interested. We can report back on that maybe, Corinne. You can tell us because then we'll have to do yes, Corinne has reported, and you'll let us know if you learn about the commercial use limit. Anyway, so awesome. Okay. Well, I think that's about all we have time for today. And I do want to say, there's a lot to say about LinkedIn that isn't just the basic stuff. Yeah. And you guys can, like we said earlier, you can look at the show notes, and there's even more you can read that's specifically for translators talking about LinkedIn. So there's way more to look into. So that's great. So thanks for tuning in, everybody. And don't forget to subscribe to Speaking of Translation, this podcast, on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, if you haven't already done that. And please feel free to leave us a comment.
Yeah. And also for anyone who subscribes to us on Spotify or Stitcher, for some reason, those feeds weren't immediately updating for a while. I don't know why. And then they suddenly started updating again.
Oh, good. Because I looked a couple of weeks ago and I was like, whatever, what can we do? It's this, you know, big behemoths. And so it did start updating again.
It did start updating again. So if you like to subscribe on Spotify or Stitcher, give it another try. And if you like this episode, you can leave a comment on our website, speakingoftranslation.com. You can review us wherever you subscribe to the podcast, or email us at speakingoftranslation@gmail.com, which someday we will convert to domain name email. Or tweet to
or
us.
Not.
Right. Or tweet to us at ebodeux, E-B-O-D-E-U-X, or Corinne McKay, and that's with one R and two N's. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we will talk to you in a future episode.